The shock of the letter seemed to reach to the extremities of his soul. To see the name written. To have complete confirmation of all the evil that they had suspected. To see the mark of the beast deeply printed and unmistakable. The shock was made greater, almost unbearable, by the contents of the letter. Peter found that such cruelty, such utter ruthlessness, tested his credibility to its limits. The letter was fluttering in his hands, and he realized with a start of surprise that he was shaking like a man in high fever. The porter carrying his black crocodile valise was staring at him curiously, and it required a huge physical effort to control his hands and fold the sheet of white paper. He stood rigidly, as though on the parade ground, until the elevator door opened, and then he marched stiffly down the passage to his suite. He gave the porter a banknote without glancing at it, and the moment the latch clicked closed, he unfolded the sheet again, and standing in the centre of the living room floor, scanned the stilted script again, and then again, until the words seemed to melt together and lose coherence and meaning. He realized that for the first time in his life, he was in complete panic, that he had lost all resolution and direction. He took a deep breath and closed his eyes, counting slowly to 100, emptying his mind completely, and then giving himself the command, think. All right, Caliph knew his movements intimately, even to when he was expected at the Dorchester. Who knew that? Cynthia, Colin Noble, Magda Altman, and the secretary at Rambouillet who had made the reservation. Colin's secretary at Thor, the Dorchester staff, and anybody else who had made even an idle study of Peter's movements would know he always stayed at the Dorchester. That was a cul-de-sac. Think! Today was April the 4th. There were 16 days before Caliph sent him Melissa Jane's severed hand. He felt the panic mounting again, and he forced it back. Think! Caliph had been watching him, studying him in detail, assessing his value. Peter's value was that he could move unsuspected in high places. He could reach the head of Atlas by simply requesting an audience. More than that, he could probably get access to any head of state if he wanted it badly enough. For the first time in his life, Peter felt the need for liquor. He crossed quickly to the cabinet and fumbled with the key. A stranger's face stared at him out of the gilt-frame mirror above it. The face was pale, haggard, with deep parentheses framing the mouth. There were plum-coloured bruises of fatigue below the eyes, and the gaunt, bony jaw was gunmetal blue with new beard, and the sapphire blue of the eyes had a wild, deranged glitter. He looked away from his own image. It only increased his sense of unreality. He poured half a tumbler of Scotch whisky and drank half of it straight off. He coughed at the sting of the liquor, and a drop of it broke from the corner of his mouth and trickled down his chin. He wiped it away with his thumb and turned back to study the sheet of white paper again. It was crumpled already, where he had gripped it too hard. He smoothed it carefully. Think, he told himself. This was how Caliph worked then. Never exposing himself, picking his agents with incredible attention to detail. Fanatics like the girl Ingrid, who had led the taking of Flight 070. Trained assassins, like the man he had killed in the river at La Pierre Benite. Experts in high places, like General Peter Stride. Studying them, assessing them and their capabilities, and finally, finding their price. Peter had never believed the old law that every man had his price. He had believed himself above that general rule. Now he knew he was not, and the knowledge sickened him. Caliph had found his price, found it unerringly. Melissa Jane. Suddenly Peter had a vivid memory of his daughter on horseback, swivelling in the saddle to laugh and call back to him, "Superstar!" and the sound of her laughter on the wind. Peter shivered. And without realizing it, he crumpled the sheet of paper to a ball in his fist. Ahead of him, he saw the road that he was destined to follow. With a new flash of insight, he realized that he had already taken his first steps along the road. He He had done so when he had put the gun to the blonde killer in the terminal of Johannesburg Airport, when he had made himself judge and executioner. Caliph had been responsible for that first step on the road to corruption, and now it was Caliph who was driving him farther along it. With a sudden prophetic glimpse ahead, Peter knew it would not end with the life of Kingston Parker. Once he was committed to Caliph, it would be forever, or until one of them, Peter Stride or Caliph, was completely destroyed. Peter drank the rest of the whiskey in the tumbler. Yes, Melissa Jane was his price. Caliph had made the correct bid. Nothing else would have driven him to it. Peter picked the booklet of matches off the liquor cabinet, and like a sleepwalker, moved through to the bathroom. He twisted the sheet of paper into a taper and lit the end of it, holding it over the toilet bowl. He held it until the flame scorched his fingers painfully, then dropped it into the bowl and flushed the ash away. He went back into the lounge and refilled the glass with whiskey. He picked the comfortable armchair below the window and sank into it. Only then did he realize how very weary he was. The nerves in his thighs quivered and twitched uncontrollably. He thought about Kingston Parker. A man like that had an incalculable amount to offer mankind. It will have to look like an assassination attempt aimed at me, Peter thought. One that finds the wrong victim. A bomb, Peter thought. He hated the bomb. Somehow it seemed to be the symbol of the senseless violence which he hated. He had seen it used in Ireland and in London, and he hated it. The undirected destruction, mindless, merciless. It will have to be a bomb, he decided. And with surprise he found that his hatred had found a new target. Again, for the first time ever, he hated himself for what he was going to do. Caliph had won. He knew that against an adversary of that caliber, there was no chance they would find where Melissa Jane was hidden. Caliph had won. And Peter Stride sat the rest of the night, planning an act which he had dedicated his life until then to prevent. I cannot understand why we haven't had the demand contact yet. Inspector Richards ran his hand distractedly across his pate, disturbing the feathery wisps that covered it, and leaving them standing out at a startled angle. It's 5 days now, still no demands.
They know where to contact Peter, Colin Noble agreed. The interview he gave covered that.
Peter Stride had appeared on BBC TV to broadcast an appeal to the kidnappers not to maim his daughter further, and to the general public to offer any information that might lead to her rescue. On the same program, they had displayed the police identikit portrait of the driver of the maroon Triumph, prepared by the one witness. The response had been overwhelming, jamming the switchboard at Inspector Richards' special headquarters, and a mixed bag had fallen into the net. A 14-year-old runaway had the police barge into the Bournemouth apartment, where she was in bed with her 32-year-old lover. She was returned weeping bitterly to the bosom of her family and had again disappeared within 24 hours. In North Scotland, the police sadly bungled a raid on a remote cottage hired by a man with the same lank dark hair and gunfighter's moustache as the identikit portrait. He turned out to be a cottage industry manufacturer of LSD tablets, and he and his four assistants, one of them a young girl who vaguely fitted the description of Melissa Jane, in that she was female and blonde, had scattered across the Highlands before being overtaken and borne to earth by sweating, pounding members of the Scottish Constabulary. Peter Stride was furious. If it had been Melissa Jane, they would have had 15 minutes in which to put her down. He raged at Richards, "You've got to let Thor go into the next raid." Through the Thor communications net, he spoke directly to Kingston Parker on the video screens. "We'll put all our influence into it," Parker agreed. And then, with deep compassion in his eyes, "Peter, I'm living every minute of this with you. I cannot escape the knowledge that I have placed you into this terrible situation. I did not expect the attack would come through your daughter. I think you know that you can call on me for any support you need." "Thank you, sir," said Peter, and for a moment felt his resolve weaken. In 10 days, he would have to execute this man. He steeled himself by thinking of a puckered, dead-white finger floating in its tiny bottle. Kingston Parker's influence worked immediately. 6 hours later, the order came down from Downing Street via the Commissioner of Police that the next raid on a suspect hideout would be conducted by Thor Command. The Royal Air Force placed 2 helicopters at Thor's disposal for the duration of the operation, and Thor's assault unit went into intensive training for penetration and removal under urban conditions. Peter trained with them, he and Colin swiftly re-establishing the old rapport of concerted action. When they were not practicing and refining the exit and assembly from the hovering helicopters, Peter spent much of his time in the enclosed pistol range, trying to drown his awareness in the crash of gunfire. But the days passed swiftly in a series of false alarms and misleading clues. Each night, when Peter examined his face in the mirror above the liquor cabinet, it was more haggard, the blue eyes muddied by fatigue and terrible gut-eroding terror of what the next day might bring forth. There were 6 days left when Peter left the hotel room before breakfast, caught the tube at Green Park, and left it again at Finsbury Park. In a garden supplies shop near the station, he purchased a 20-pound plastic bag of ammonium nitrate garden fertilizer. He carried it back to the Dorchester in a locked Samsonite suitcase and stored it in the closet behind his hanging trench coat. That night, when he spoke to Magda Altman, she pleaded once again to be allowed to come to London. "Peter, I know I can be of help to you, even if it's just to stand beside you and hold your hand." "No, we've been over that." He could hear the brutal tone in his own voice, but he could not control it. He knew that he was getting very close to the edge. "Have you heard anything?" "I'm sorry, Peter. Nothing, absolutely nothing. My sources are doing all that is possible." Peter bought the dieseline from a pump at the Lex garage in Brewer Street. He took 5 litres in a plastic screw-topped container that had contained a household detergent. The pump attendant was a pimply teenager in dirty overalls. He was completely uninterested in the transaction. In his bathroom, Peter worked on the dieseline and the nitrate from the garden shop. He produced 21 pounds of savagely weight-efficient high explosive that was nonetheless docile until activated by a blasting cap, such as he had devised with a flashlight bulb. It would completely devastate the entire suite, utterly destroying everybody and everything in it. However, the damage should be confined to those 3 rooms. It would be a simple matter to lure Kingston Parker to the suite under the pretense of having urgent information about Caliph to deliver. Information so critical that it could only be delivered in person and in private. That night, the face in the mirror above the liquor cabinet was that of a man suffering from a devouring terminal disease, and the whiskey bottle was empty. Peter broke the seal on a fresh bottle. It would make it easier to sleep, he told himself. The wind came off the Irish Sea like the blade of a harvester's scythe, and the low, lead-coloured cloud fled up the slopes of the Wicklow Hills ahead of it. There were weak patches in the cloud layer through which a cold and sickly sun beamed swiftly across the green, forested slopes. As it passed, so the rain followed, icy grey rain slanting in on the wind. A man came up the deserted street of the village. The tourists had not yet begun the annual invasion, but the bed and breakfast signs were already out to welcome them on the fronts of the cottages.